here we are. Okay. So, we've been looking at the syllabus again, and now has everybody's been able to get onto Blackboard? Is that right? Any problems with that? So, I do think there will be one more little thing that we want to supplement for you graduate students, and we have had things like book reviews in the past and formal presentations. We're going to cut this down and streamline it again because of the weighty nature of the novels that we're reading. So instead, we're going to create a list of articles for you to write a short report on. This would be like a three paragraph report on an article, and this will be due right around the beginning of study for term paper season. Okay, and these will not be presented in class, but will be posted on our handy dandy Blackboard site.
These are grad students.
For graduate students, right. Now you undergraduates, you see, you'll be able to read these reports of these articles. And this is a wonderful thing. Now don't be confused and think that that counts as a full-fledged reference. You know, you can refer to the short version, the shrink-lit version of the article. No, it's just to point you in a direction that might be helpful for you. But it will be helpful to the whole class. In other words, to do this short labor, this will form about, 10% of your grade accordingly. So we'll review the percentages on the grades for graduates and undergraduates next week. Okay. We're starting a new novel, and a wonderful novel it is, and we have a lot to say about Turgenev. As we study Turgenev, we're moving ahead in time into the turbulent 1850s and 1860s of Russian literature, the kind of the high point, the generating point out of which so much comes. And really, if we think about greatness in the novel, the Russians were the first to achieve true greatness in the novel. And in a sense, I think we're able to say that they taught the rest of the world how to read a novel. And no novel could do that quite as well as Fathers and Sons. Because with Gogol, as you saw, we had a brilliant author, a brilliant poet, who had written a poema, as his subtitle is, gives it in Dead Souls, a visionary, but one who, in a sense, gives us the sense that we don't know what's coming next. We're turning the pages in Dead Souls because we don't know what's coming next. What next will the author be able to think up? What amazing chaotic scene will he place before us? What strange ironic digression will he give us? In Fathers and Sons, you're turning the pages because you want to know what happens next. The novel has become an organic, well-oiled thing in which you are plunged into the action achieves its full fruition. So there's more to say about the contrast of Gogol and Turgenev, and we'll move on into that. But we talked a little bit about the desire for, the need for, the demand for a true Russian hero, an authentic hero, and the inability to provide that as a critical problem, as a desire by the public, and so forth. And we have to remember that the authentic writer, right, who is dedicated to the truth of his craft, cannot depict what is not there. He cannot simply make up a hero and paste him into the landscape. What these novels that we are reading show us by and large is the terrible malaise that has fallen on a vital and deeply mythic people in this time of westernization, of modernization. Now, we talked about Peter the Great before. What he and his successor, Catherine the Great, brought in from the West was not its best ideals, but instead the secularized ideals of the Enlightenment, an essential secularism that infected the minds of the Russian intelligentsia. We have to recognize this shock, which has since been happening all over the world in technology's wake. Russia was the first to feel this disjunction. Again, with Gogol, we are indebted to the style of the, of his both of his language and of his vision. Dr. Dupree mentioned briefly this term ostranenie, defamiliarization. And this truly is Gogol's specialty. Nothing could be more defamiliarized than a St. Petersburg cityscape, which looks perfectly normal, except that there's a very dignifiedly dressed nose stepping out of a carriage and ready to walk into Kazan Cathedral, where he will piously pray. All right. Defamiliarization. What does that do? That makes everything strange, right? It has an infectious capacity. And so that kind of shock is conveyed in that way by Gogol. Turgenev shifts the balance so that the shock is not in the means of expression, the shock is in the thing expressed. He's showing the drama itself. In a sense, he takes the shock out of it and gives us a story that we can immerse ourselves in and feel one with. But in so doing, he's portraying the essential drama of his times as he has experienced and perceived it. This is a time in which the connection with this deeply pious folk was severed, as was the almost mystical relation to the soil. The Russian myth of Holy Russia, a nation dedicated, as we've said, to a special mission for the world, was almost overnight made to seem irrelevant and superstitious. As the capital of Russia was transferred from the holy city of Moscow to the new enlightened city of St. Petersburg, so too the Russian soul, as some authorities have put it, was cleft in two. Now it will be Dostoevsky who shows us the depth and significance of this split. But this evening, or this afternoon, where are we? Evening or afternoon? We take up a work by a writer who was the first of the Russian novelists to be discovered by Europe and America, Ivan Turgenev, of whom Henry James commented, "It is from his writings almost alone that we of English, French, and German speech have derived our notions of the Russian people." Turgenev came as a messenger out of the dark depths of the Russian steppe into the Western world, and was beloved by high French culture, by Henry James, by all novelists who were aspiring in the Western world. Ernest Renan, the French writer who wrote his New Enlightened Vie de Jésus, right, had commented at the funeral of Turgenev. Turgenev received by the mysterious decree which marks out human vocations, the gift which is noble beyond all others. He was born essentially impersonal. His conscience was not that of an individual to whom nature had been more or less generous. It was in some sort the conscience of a people. Renan goes on, before he was born, he had lived for thousands of years. Infinite successions of reveries had amassed themselves in the depths of his heart. No man has been as much as he, the incarnation of a whole race. Generations of ancestors, lost in the sleep of centuries, speechless, came through him to life and utterance. Now, Renan has a tendency to, you know, to over-dramatize, perhaps. But what is it that he is perceiving? He's perceiving an essential kernel about Turgenev when he talks about Turgenev's impersonality and at the same time the fact that he expresses a sense, a sensibility of an entire people. And writer after writer has said this in one way or another about Turgenev. As a person, Henry James said of him simply, "I found him adorable." Referring to his modesty, his humor, his charm, his serenity. But Turgenev as a person was at his best away from Russia. Yes,
So did Henry James meet Turgenev?
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah. Turgenev spoke English?
James spoke French.
And they both spoke
French. Yeah. That's the literary language extraordinaire. Russians, however, right, always kind of held back from him somewhat, sensing something foreign in his work. And he had indeed mastered his style and his artistry abroad. He spent half his life in Europe, intimate with a group of writers around Flaubert. Though he could not settle in Russia, he was always nostalgic for it. He learned much in the way of technique and style from his association with European authors, but always his heart and his imagination worked with his native material. He was Russian to the core in his essential vision. Now, what was perhaps missing in his work, which made his Russian detractors consider him European, was any emphasis on the peasant's depth and wisdom. At the time of this brilliant flare-up of genius in the novel, there had begun in Russia the Narodnik movement, right? Which, again, influenced with ideas from outside, influenced with ideas from Europe, among them Johann Herder, emphasized that the future of Russia is in the folk, is in its folk. Right? So we might call it a kind of a folk nationalism. Narod means folk, or the people. The destiny of Russia had seemed to many intellectuals at this time to lie with the folk. And instead, Turgenev gives us an elegant sense of the landed aristocrats and of what has happened to the best and brightest of Russian youth. Now, Turgenev grew up in an aristocratic household at Spaskoye Estate outside Moscow. Yes, huh?
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. So are you saying he's part of this movement or he's different?
Oh, yeah, different, right.
Different.
So this is what's lacking. In other words, we have a sense of the Russian picture as a whole
without
in Gogol, but in Turgenev, what we're seeing is really the aristocrats.
Okay. Right.
Now, this is ironic because, as we're going to go over the progress of his development, his first really successful work depicted the serfs together with their masters in the sportsman's sketches. But, you know, this has not been the essence of his work. So he grew up in an aristocratic household. Outside Moscow, his father was an impoverished squire, his mother an heiress. Her husband, his father, did not love her, was a philanderer, died when, I believe, Turgenev was 15 or 16, and his mother was an embittered tyrant, cruel to her serfs. One story has it that she killed one for crying excessively and domineering with her son. Turgenev graduated. He was first sent to the University of Moscow, then transferred to the University of Petersburg, and then went abroad to study in Berlin, to study where Hegel had been having a great deal of influence on the young Russian idealists. So his 3 years in Germany gave Turgenev a lifelong love for Western culture. When he came back to Russia, he tried a career at civil service, but after only 2 years, gave it up and devoted himself entirely to literature. Now, so, 1818 to 1883 are his dates. So we're talking really about a generation already that's in European time, Euro-American, you know, the Atlantic community, as some political experts have termed it. 1818, 1819, 1820, 1821, a set of years that created an enormous number of significant authors besides Turgenev. We have have Flaubert himself, we have Dostoevsky. Not 1821. We have, of course, Karl Marx, 1818. We have, in America, Melville, Whitman. Oh, good Lord, there are a number of others. Anybody think of anybody else born between 1818 and 1821? I think Charles Baudelaire was born around the same year. 1821. What do all these people have in common? It's anybody's guess, I suppose, but they are all post-romantics. Right? This is all the first really strong post-romantic generation. If you look at romanticism, it really consists of two generations. The first one is the intellectually strong one. The second one is the one that branches out into all the into different forms of expression, and sort of the first first generation for which life as a form of art becomes becomes something significant. But this generation, all in some way, are disillusioned with the world around them, maintain their romantic ideals. You could say this is true of Flaubert, of Baudelaire, especially. You could say it in a way is true of Karl Marx himself, right? Too. All of them are struggling between, on the one hand, an extreme, almost blinding vision of romantic idealism, and on the other hand, a cold-eyed look at the world around them that they realize is incapable of ever being united with those ideals without some terrific blow being dealt. Marx, of course, wants to do that. Directly, some of our authors are more concerned with portraying that conflict. We see that conflict portrayed in an author like Melville, right? In Captain Ahab, the destructive character, as Walter Benjamin calls this kind of character. But this continues to ripple through the Western world of writing for the authors of this time. So now Turgenev showed his talent as a writer early and won the...
Sorry, I'm still a little confused on your folk nationalism. You said that is something that Turgenev did not...
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did not use. Okay.
Was not a part of, and so was not embraced as fully as he might have been by the Russians. But he did have success early. Won the favor of the Russian critics, who, as you know by now, were hard to please. Right. And here we are talking about, what's the big three? The big one being Belinsky, but also Chernyshevsky. Can you all read my handwriting? And Dobrolyubov, which means good love. Dobrolyubov. In one way or another, these three shaped literary opinion constantly in the Russia of Turgenev's time. And again, and in a story that's going to resemble what you have already heard about Gogol and have heard and will hear about Dostoevsky, the first real work of Turgenev was a smashing success with these authors. And it was later, after he revealed more and more who he really was, that they were less pleased with him. Now perhaps that's explainable because we have to recall just how tightly clamped the Russian world of literary expression was under Tsar Nicholas, who had reacted very strongly against all forms of freedom as dangerous. The outburst of democracy in the world from the French Revolution, the experience of Napoleonic desire to conquer that Russia had to deal with so bitterly, in the siege, then the Decembrist Revolution, right, that we've dwelt on before in 1825, all of these led Nicholas to turn from someone who essentially believed in freedom of the serfs, modernization, freedom for all, to as a protector of the realm, someone who must clamp down on everything, and as you know, essentially to completely not even try to understand an author like Gogol, who was, if anything, more to the right of the Tsar himself, right? And instead to make Gogol a forbidden author, Turgenev, by this time, Turgenev really simply won glory and fame for himself by being persecuted by the Tsarist regime, the Tsarist police. Turgenev was put under house arrest for 18 months for having written a tribute to Gogol at Gogol's death. So he said something about how all of Russia is poorer without Gogol. This was considered controversial. This was considered going too far. And so Turgenev was placed under house arrest. And when he returned, he found that he was the co-celeb of Petersburg. And essentially, his word was gold. this was around... Gogol's death was in 1852. So by that time... Turgenev, here's a slip, had written two things that were of great note. One was called A Sportsman's Sketches, and these had come out in the journals. They were short sketches from 1847, and then the book was published in 1852. And then the diary of a superfluous man. Superfluous man, of course, is Lermontov's term. It's already exemplified in Oblomov, whom, of course, you know, the man who couldn't get out of bed, or who almost didn't get out of bed. And it reminds us that in authors everywhere, there's always a dialogue going around, a constant kind of trading of ideas, of concepts, of themes, motifs, images, in which one cites the other and, in a sense, perhaps pays tribute or gives a slap, you know, as the case may be. All of these things, far from being the most important thing about our literary writers, they show the kind of community of letters that's always at work. It's a community of ideas, themes, and motifs as well. But the Sportsman's Sketches really were basically just as if notebook entries from a man who was walking throughout Russia and saw, collecting some game as he went along with his gun, and he would then see various things happening, various interactions between landowners and their serfs, other hunters, and so forth and so on. These were, in other words, kind of slice of life stories, and they were a great sensation because they were different. They were different. They were not tales told, to grab us by the collar and make a point. They were sketches of the way life is. And what could be more controversial than to dare to show way life is, to show that the serfs actually at times seemed more imaginative, more generous, more virtuous than their owners, than the squires, who seemed often vulgar and blockheaded and peremptory and so forth. This was a revolutionary thing. And so that was why Belinsky and the others embraced him, and the Tsar became suspicious of him, which together made a great success in Petersburg. So over about 10 years, right, from 1852 to 1862, he was the toast of the town and wrote several works. The Diary of a Superfluous Man is the person who is invaded by a curious kind of ennui, cannot make decisions, cannot take on responsibility, a J. Alfred Prufrock, if you will. This kind of figure has run through 19th and 20th century literature. And Turgenev was prophetic in diagnosing the malady so effectively. Now, he went on in 1856, a novel, Rudin. And in 1857, A Nest of Gentlefolk, which actually is quite sympathetic toward those gentlefolk, although the term nest makes it sound. And indeed, Turgenev had perfected a way of looking with a sympathetic condescension toward people that you are already able to see, I think, in Fathers and Sons. In both these novels, he wrote sympathetically of the ideals of the older generation, but Rudin portrays their ineffectiveness of the older generation, and the gentlefolk looks more lovingly at the old orthodoxy. All this time. Now we have to know, you know, what was behind some of this eager taking up of Turgenev, right? What were the ideas, ideologies of this time? There was, of course, utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham. And Mill, the English philosophers, the pragmatism, not the later American form, but the continental form of Mill and Spencer. All of these mid-century ideologies that claimed that we must stop thinking in idealistic ways, must stop trying to assimilate the old traditions or transform them. We must replace them with more practical ways of thinking. And of course, that would include evolutionary theory, the higher criticism of the Bible and of Christianity, and still more in general, the materialism. And you can parse these ways of thinking more finely, certainly, if you study this era, the middle of the 19th century, but these are all things that you will find represented well in the thought of those three who I just erased, Belinsky, Chernyshevsky, and Dobrolyubov. Turgenev, however, as we shall see, was less concerned with either promoting or denouncing revolutionary thought than with studying its nature and manifestations. All this time that he had written these successful works, he had not been able to produce the picture of a Russian hero, that topic that was much in the mind of Russian literary critics. Another work in 1860 called On the Eve did study a revolutionary character who's had a great impact on the woman he loved. We have a kind of impressive trajectory of these revolutionary figures toward death, a new generation, and so forth. But there's a problem. They were Bulgarian, or rather, the revolutionary himself was Bulgarian, in Sarov. So that couldn't count for Russians. And, you know, I mean, if you look at the situation at the time, it's in a sense more real because the Bulgarian revolutionary movement at that time was an independence movement. They were still under the boot of the Ottoman Empire and were seeking to get free of it. Russia itself had collaborated with the Ottoman Empire to keep Bulgaria under the Ottomans because the Bulgarians had believed that they were a union church that wanted to go back and reunite with Rome, and the Russian Orthodox didn't want that. And so this was something of a more robust revolutionary movement, different from the Russian one, still doable, but in a sense not valid for our Russians. So he was severely criticized for this choice of hero. It was all this that led Turgenev to attempt in Fathers and Sons to portray a strong young Russian leader in Bazarov. The furor over this novel was so great that Turgenev had to leave Russia for good. Why, you ask? Well, again, both sides thought he had done the wrong thing. Right? The Belenskys were furious at him and thought he had done a caricature of their movement, and the conservatives and the readers in general. Well, it was unfortunate that this novel was published the same year that there was a great fire in St. Petersburg that almost leveled the city. And it seemed almost clearly to have been arson. And no one knows to this day who started it, but it was widely thought that it was done by our student radicals in Petersburg in 1862. And so, when this was reported and was discussed endlessly in the journals and so forth, what was the term they used? Nihilists! It was nihilists that did this. The word was invented by Turgenev. The word was invented in the very novel we're reading. Right? I am a nihilist, says Bazarov. Right? Whose name, clearly enough, if we accent it on the middle accent, means he's taken his ideas from the marketplace of ideas, the bazaar of ideas. So, in that sense, too, it is somewhat of a caricature. But how wrong we are if we think that the entire character is a caricature. It's just that it has those notes that are added to it by Turgenev in search of a complete portrait of a human being. But it seems like the last thing that any reader wanted was a complete portrait of a human being. This is just one of those episodes that tells us, alas, we human race, all we want is confirmation of our own ideas, isn't it? Either that or escape, right, into an easy read, right? And so Turgenev, disgusted at his public and no longer in favor with them, left Russia. He had, incidentally, fallen in love with a mezzo-soprano, Pauline Viardot, who was the toast of French music, and the parts for her had been written in operas by Gounod and Berlioz and Saint-Saëns, right? So she was an amazing singer, herself a composer and pianist, and Turgenev in 1843 became so smitten with her his mother noticed and wrote to him disinheriting him because of this dalliance that he had with a married opera singer. Now there's some evidence that after that this relationship was entirely chaste, he moved in with them, with Pauline and her husband once he left Russia and went to France. France and Germany moved between, Paris and Baden-Baden and all the high spots of the Franco-German high culture opera scene, which, of course, corresponded with the high culture literary scene. And it was there that he got to know Flaubert and Prosper Mérimée and Henry James. And he was one of the first, I think perhaps the first, to recognize the talent of Guy de Maupassant, And if you read any Maupassant, you will find a great deal of influence by Turgenev. All of this away from his mother, Russia, his native Russia. So this is someone, at the same time, this relationship with Pauline is somewhat touching, you know, because there he was, living in the same house, always accepted by the husband, had come to consider the children his own, and then in his latter days, he'd had stomach cancer and had a horrible pain, no way of treatment for it, and Pauline was very tender to him in his last few years, where he died at 65. So rejected in Russia, he was the celebrity in France, and then that means the whole Western literary world. We have to ask, what is it that he accomplished that so struck Henry James and other writers? Yes.
Did his popularity in Russia continue even after his exile?
Unpopularity?
Well,
I would say, you know, in a sense, they've never been appreciated quite as much. Gogol is considered, you know, the father of realism, the father of Russian literature. You know, Pushkin is our Shakespeare, and so forth. And I think Turgenev has no such title. I may be wrong, but one bit of evidence I saw was that someone introducing one of his works writes that in today's Russian textbooks, the students are taught that Bazarov is an unsatisfactory character.
Did he ever have the desire to go back?
No question about that. And he did go back. It's just that he spent most of his time in France and Germany. And in a sense, was always high-handed with the Russians, because he had a chip on his shoulder about them. Whereas he was extremely gracious with, you know, the French and with Henry James. Who wouldn't be with Henry James? Wouldn't know how to treat him. But, yes, uh-huh.
Two things that have been confusing. First of all, was Turgenev so radical as Bazarov in his political views? Because I was under the impression he was kind of in the middle and trying to portray opposite extremes.
Well, I mean, short answer, no, he wasn't. I do want to get to some of the things that he's said about Bazarov and Turgenev's own statements. Because we're leading to a different concept of art. In a sense, we can make this contrast between Gogol and Turgenev, a contrast between the poet and the artist. Poet as a visionary, so still somewhat in the romantic mode, as Gogol is, who, it seems, is almost doing notation of the things that have come into his mind, you know. And then when he thinks about his medium, why, he gets off into the most digressive things, right? But Turgenev, the artist, is making something. He's making something that is itself going to hold everything that he sees. And this is where Henry James got his notion about a mind so fine, no idea could penetrate it, right? Which sounds like an insult, but is, of course, a great compliment for this. Beyond ideas, to make something. And the idea is the vision is going to come out of what you make. It's in that process of making and refining. If you ever read Flaubert's journal entries about Madame Bovary, you see this same process at work. And here's what Turgenev said. First of all, about the artist's necessity to create in images and scenes, he says, those only who cannot do better will submit to a preconceived program. Because a truly talented writer is the condensed expression of life itself. And he cannot write either a panegyric or a pamphlet. Either would be too mean for him. Now about the character of Bazarov. Bazarov puts all the other personalities of my novel in the shade. He is honest, straightforward, and a democrat of the purest water. And you find no good qualities in him. The duel with Pavel, I don't want to give any spoilers here, but is only introduced to show the intellectual emptiness of the elegant, noble knighthood. In fact, I even exaggerated and made it ridiculous. My conception of Bazarov is such as to make him appear throughout much superior to Pavel. Nevertheless, when he calls himself nihilist, you must read revolutionist. to draw on one side a functionary who takes bribes and on the other an ideal youth? I leave it to others to make such pictures. Right. My aim was much higher than that. I conclude with one remark. If the reader is not won by Bazarov, notwithstanding his roughness, absence of heart, pitiless dryness, and terseness, then the fault is with me. I have missed my aim, but to sweeten him with syrup, to use Bazarov's own language, this I did not want to do, although perhaps through that I would have won Russian youth at once to my side. You can hear the, you know, the suppressed anger here. You see what he's talking about, right? He wants to portray life as it is. And his focus is not ideas. His focus is not ideology. His focus is life. And he is indeed someone passionately concerned about what happens in life and what life does to change us as well. And that, I think, more than anything else, describes the plot of what happens in Fathers and Sons. Yeah, Angela?
Isn't by portraying Bazarov as the hero, though, isn't that necessarily taking sides and choosing an ideology?
He's the hero. The hero is not necessarily the good guy. I mean, we need not put a Superman cape on him. But he is unquestionably the main character. Mm-hmm. Right? He's the one that has the most force, the one that the novel is drawn to, it's magnetized around. We may approve of him or disapprove of him. And indeed, if it were in life, you know, if we were in the same, if we were in life as he was, then we might have to condemn him. But the portrait of him is a rounded person. And that's the unique ability that fiction gives us, isn't it? You know, to experiment by seeing life without having to be involved with judging it. So, you know, how do you do that? This is the art that Flaubert was learning. This is the art that Turgenev was learning, and that James became ecstatic about, that Conrad became ecstatic about, that Caroline Gordon in her day, in our little corner of the world in Dallas, preached and taught unremittingly in her creative writing program here. Yes?
The term nihilist is really confusing me because I know the Russians did not use it in quite the same way that, like, the French used it. And they were using...
Can you explain?
My dictionary had it listed separately for a Russian definition. And I understood it to be a not wanting any kind of authority,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to overthrow the old ways. Did that include nihilism as an atheism, or did it just include we don't want anything to do with the czar and we don't want serfs?
I mean, first of all, about terms. Terms are always, where do they come from? You know, and they're markers used by us as journalists to try to navigate our way through this world of different arguments and so forth. We have the advantage that here, right before us, in Fathers and Sons, we have the text, the origin of the word nihilist. So nobody's better for telling us than Bazarov himself,
mm-hmm.
what a nihilist is. Yeah. So
I didn't understand if he was saying he's an atheist, though.
Well,
is he supposed to be?
I mean, I'm not sure if that's foremost in Turgenev's mind to show that. He certainly doesn't seem, for the great part of the novel, to believe in anything spiritual at all. But, so, wait and see. Wait and see. Apparently you haven't read the end. Because, it's time to talk about the amazing antinomies of this novel. And, it just occurred, things that occurred to me about the art of Turgenev. Before Turgenev and Flaubert, the novel was thought of as a different form. Really, as you know, if you've studied the history of the novel, not much of an artwork in itself. The first glimmering of the idea of the novel might be an artwork was with the Romantic generation, but it was not until the time of Flaubert and Turgenev that it was really began to be achieved in this way. So we had our Cervantes, we had our French novelists, we had, you know, our Henry Fielding, our Jane Austen, and in all of these, the novel is primarily a story that is told, right? So, you know, what happened, in other words, is the main thing. But the process of making a is what makes a work of art, right? It's the how and not just the what. And the first generation of those that were able to focus on that problem were Turgenev's generation. So, and look at the antinomies in this novel. You know, here he is, the inventor of a controversial term in political philosophy, and yet someone who himself says, I'm beyond politics, I'm beyond taking sides, my interest is in life, right? You know, so we have to look at, I think, the kind of idea that was given to us in English literary criticism by John Keats, who in his letters, who talks about negative capability. He says when a person is able to remain in a state of doubt, of uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Right? So the mind of the poet, Keats suggests, is one that is able to hold all these different oppositions at once without having to resolve them as we do in practical life, as we do in intellectual life as well. And that is what makes art great, according to Keats. And Keats said, you know, if a sparrow come before my window, I take part in its existence and pick about in the gravel. And you might, incidentally, and this is completely not an influence question, but you might notice the role of sparrows in this novel. Turgenev does a lot with them as well. Keats said, a poet is the most unpoetical thing of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually informing and filling some other body. So this is, in fact, almost a cult that does develop in the idea that of self-negation of the artist. The artist negates himself, negates his wishes, his ideas, his own personality, expressing them all. It's a sublimation process, right? It's like a sexual abstinence in order for all your eroticism to come out in all other forms of say, good deeds or something, right? And in this case, all of his will, all of one's ego, comes out in the power of one's characters. If you're good at your art. So, now Turgenev again says, critics in general do not quite correctly conceive what goes on in an author's soul. They're completely convinced that all an author does is to convey his ideas. They do not wish to believe that to reproduce the truth, the reality of life, accurately and powerfully, is the literary man's highest joy. Even if that truth does not correspond to his own sympathies. So as he writes about Bazarov, simply, that is how life turned out. Right? He had his, you know, his convictions, his principles, his preferences. That is how life turned out. And again, you're going to have to read all the novel to see what that means. Right? Experience told me, he said, and I had to depict him precisely that way. My personal inclinations meant nothing here. So the art of fiction as the art of distillation of what one has seen about people and life. And this is the note struck over and over again by those who write about the great well-made novel. Again, the tradition of Flaubert and of James and of Joseph Conrad and others. So on the one hand, we have an art that gives us scenes that are full of lyricism and impressionism. Talks all about the flowering trees and the birds singing. And you notice the kind of details that he gives us that are just rich in color and music and so forth. And on the other hand, a strong, clear Aristotelian arc to the action. The action is relentless. It's moving, like a drama. Right? None of that digressiveness or episodicness of Gogol. We have a novel, and I'm, you know, not going to say a lot here, but because I don't want to spoil it, but that combines tragedy and comedy as a novel should. Right? Is a true combination of tragedy and comedy, and oh my goodness, you know, just, you know, make sure you're not in a public place when you read those last those last several chapters, because you know, here you're going to cry tears of joy, and 20 pages later you're going to cry bitter tears of sorrow, unless you're just not the kind of person who can squeeze a tear out on. It's quite amazing, and the rapidity with which that ending happens is just devastating. But Chekhov wrote about this novel, about, you know, how he is delirious because of it, and said that when one of the characters gets sick, he feels infected by it himself. You know? And Chekhov, you know, was needless to say, a great artist himself. The sentiment on the one hand, the iron structure on the other, the way Turgenev handles these moments of greatest emotional intensity is not to be hands off and say, I'm not going to say too much, but is to plunge us into sentiment, you know, and at the same time, always to keep in mind the entire world that he's been showing us all along. So wit, structure, purpose are all there. The discordant note is always there because that's the way life is. Romance on the one hand, and that's of course what novels are all about, isn't it? This is the perfect novel, it's the complete novel. And it's been said, it's true, you know. It's the perfect novel. You have a romance that you really come to just throb about, you know. And then on the other hand, I want to read you something that Edward Garnett wrote. Edward Garnett is the husband of Constance Garnett, okay. And these were literary figures, or paraliterary figures, or minor literary figures around the time of Joseph Conrad. And Edward Garnett wrote an introduction to a translation of On the Eve, in which he said, Turgenev's genius was of the same force in politics as in art. It was that of seeing aright, he says. He goes on to say, because of Turgenev's creation of a universal national type, which is what he does with Bazarov, creation of a universal national type in his fiction, he was not merely an artist, but a poet, using fiction as his medium. And that one should compare in this regard, he says, Jane Austen, a great exponent of the domestic novel, who, he says, is absolutely wanting in this poetic insight. He says, she painted most admirably the English types she knew, and how well she knew them, but she failed to correlate them with the national life. And he says, at that time, think of what was happening. Waterloo, you know, all the climactic moments of English political history were happening, all blithely ignored by Jane Austen. Right. Compare Turgenev, right, who plunges us into the heart of Russian controversy and Russian national life. So that dimension of communal destiny in the novel, whether it be national or whatever body politic we're talking about, is indispensable in the making of a great novel. Without it, the novel cannot be profound. It has to have many dimensions. And it cannot simply be about our own, about a person's private life, or about, you know, domestic relations, romantic relations. All of that is, of course, it's the meat and potatoes of novels. But if it's that alone, without the greater implications, it cannot be a profound novel. For our comparison, we would have to think again of the scheme of biblical exegesis derived in the Middle Ages that had a literal, an allegorical, a moral, and an anagogical level. There were ascending levels of meaning. And although we cannot really correspond exactly to those guidelines for our understanding, there is always something like that at work in the novel. The novel is passionately about people and their close relations with each other, but what if it is not about a whole people at the same time, and ultimately about the human race, you know, then what do we have? So this is something that I think Turgenev was so good at achieving. So that, I think, I wanted to dwell on Turgenev's art, well, partly because we can't dwell on all of the novel yet. We haven't quizzed you yet. We have a whole other class to talk about the action of the novel, the characters in the novel, and I'm eager to do that just because of the way that you can read in a scene. But look at some of the examples that we can get in the scenes here in Fathers and Sons. I had some earmarked. Sorry. Hold on. First chapter, second chapter, the way in which Nikolai's mind and character are revealed in the first observable details of the novel. Right. It's his master there, first chapter, waiting 5 hours for his son. We know already what this relation between father and son is going to be. The father has, in a sense, invested too much in his son. All right, he adores him and looks, of course, as Aristotle says, to find a certain immortality in one's offspring, right, and a continuation of his own life in his son's life. But when his son appears, he is not the same. That the way that the end of the first chapter, the way that the waiting is portrayed, and talks about Nikolai's past. But look at the last long paragraph, that Nikolai Petrovich bowed his head and began to stare at the crumbling steps. A big mottled hen walked sedately towards him, treading firmly with its thick yellow legs. I'm sorry, I've got a different translation. Dirty cat, do you see where this is?
Mm-hmm.
Cast a disapproving look at him as she twisted herself coyly around the railing. All of these non-ideal details in this ideal world that Nikolai is imagining and hoping for. The sun was scorching. A smell of hot rye bread was wafted from the dim entrance of the posting station. All the senses are involved. He creates a whole world, right? Nikolai Petrovich started musing. My son, a graduate, Arkasha. He remembered his dead wife. She did not live to see it, he murmured sadly. A plump blue pigeon flew onto the road and hurriedly started to drink water from a puddle near the well. Nikolai Petrovich began to watch it, but his ear had already caught the sound of approaching wheels. Notice all the senses involved here, right? And the fact that, you know, nature, just these kinds of details that we would edit out are brought in, remind us, life goes on. You know, you're fantasizing about your son, you're mourning your dead wife, life goes on. You know, they don't care. Pigeons don't care. And at the beginning of the second chapter, let me shake myself first, Daddy, said Arkady, in a voice rather tired from traveling, but boyish and resonant, as he responded gaily to his father's greetings, I'm covering you with dust. I'm covering you with dust, Daddy. We didn't notice that the first time around, but the whole theme is expressed in this statement, right? The son buries the father, right?
Our translation is
what do you have in
lacking. There? It says, I'll get you dirty.
I'll get you dirty. Too bad.
Same thing.
Yeah, that doesn't quite do it. And then the early descriptions of Bazarov in chapter 2, right? Again, we don't have an introduction by an overvoice, right? In fact, you know, Arkady could easily be made to give a little thumbnail sketch of who his friend Bazarov is, but instead we see him directly and going up to a tall man. Well, what have we got here in your translation? A tall man, walking up to a tall man, page 7, wearing a long, loose coat with tassels, who had just gotten out of the carriage. He warmly shook that man's bare, reddened hand, which hadn't been extended to him immediately. So, tiniest details here, man. The reddened hand, the hand has not been extended. Bazarov doesn't stand on ceremony. May I ask your first name and patronymic, says Nikolai, who's making over him a good deal. Bazarov simply says, Evgeny Vasilich, Bazarov answered in a lazy but powerful voice, and turning down the collar of his coat, revealed his entire face to Nikolai Petrovich. It was long and thin, a broad forehead, a nose that was flat at the base and sharp at the tip, large greenish eyes, and drooping sandy-colored sideburns. His face was illuminated by a calm smile, radiating self-assurance and intelligence. I hope you won't find it too boring at our home, dear Yevgeny Vasilich. Bazarov's thin lips moved almost imperceptibly. He made no formal reply. He merely took off his cap. Our first impression of him is of a boor, so somebody who has an enormously overinflated opinion of himself, right? Or if we notice at all, because this is just by the tiniest detail, Turgenev is not only telling us about this character, but he's bringing us into this world so that we become so attuned to it that the details matter so much. And on it goes. There are several other examples there of Bazarov acting boorishly in the very end. He takes out a pipe and begins smoking and says to the driver of the carriage, "Well, hurry up, bushy beard," right, and so forth. And so the intention here is to give us, make some dissonance in this character. If we're going to come to, you know, have a feeling that he is the hero of this novel, if we're going to be won over by him in some way, it's going to take some work. It's going to take an enormous amount of momentum to do that. So, okay. Now, so this is unmistakably Turgenev's wish, because he does later, all of the comments that I had given to you were later comments that he wrote in retrospect, looking at the unfortunate reception of Fathers and Sons and what he had really intended. And in fact, letters that he wrote to individual readers, right, rather aristocratic readers and so forth, but ones that tried to set them on the right path toward what he was doing with his art. Right? So that's, I wanted to dwell on that topic here for a while. Any other comments or questions here that you all have about the novel? Yes.
It says some large protuberances on his capacious head.
Yes.
On page 7, what is that supposed to mean? Has he has like some kind of massive surgery or something?
I don't think so. Bumps. Remember that this was the era of phrenology, and bumps on your head were supposed to mean something. What? I don't know. Any questions, Arlen? No. Any questions or thoughts here?
This is going back a little bit. You were setting up antipodes,
mm-hmm.
And you started on romance. I missed what the.
I did too. Did I not complete that one?
Second one.
Well, the idea is the soft and the hard, the comic, the tragic, the impressionistic, and the. And the narrow-eyed plot, romance and national destiny. And indeed, after a while you realize these antinomies that seem like things that have nothing to do with each other and are almost opposites of each other are what the novel is about. They embrace the novel in general. So we get our idea that, in that sense, Turgenev is teaching us how to read a novel. His comments as a critic, in other words, his critical comments to readers outside the novel about how to read the novel have to do repeatedly with, you know, I'm not pushing an idea here. I didn't come up with a character as the embodiment of an idea and have him running around in the novel. But I saw how people are in the world. He said, I couldn't help but have it be about ideas because all of you people, all of you other writers, had been ignoring that in Russia, and it's everywhere in Russia. Right? This nihilism that I invented, I didn't invent it. You know, nobody else had written about it. So I couldn't help but do that. But how does it turn out really in life? How does it turn out in a person's life? Doesn't life take over? And of course, that's exactly what happens in Fathers and Sons. Yeah, Angela.
So would this sort of be going against the grain of someone like Hawthorne, who does sort of use characters to embody ideals, even though this probably came a little bit after that? I mean, is that sort of...
Hawthorne is just a shade before Turgenev. Yeah.
Is he...
And allegorical, you can still talk about allegory in Hawthorne. You can't really talk about it in Turgenev. Although he's embodying ideas and so forth, that's not an allegorical process at all. Hawthorne is aware of allegory, and romantic allegorists tend to be ironic and witty about their use of allegory. Baudelaire does the same. And they're part of that last generation of romantic allegorists. Yes,
And another class I was in, the professor mentioned that she found Dostoevsky to be allegorical. Do you agree with that, or do you think he moves back towards allegory or continues to go?
Dostoevsky's a complicated case. He's no Turgenev, that's for sure.
Okay.
Although.
So you almost have to take him on a completely different.
Yeah, it's going to take a while for us to parse Dostoevsky entirely. That's why we've got a lot of time with him, but it's a good question. Yes.
So would, if just for the sake of argument, you could say that Dostoevsky does employ like more, sort of more allegory, or more allegorical theology. I don't even know how to articulate this.
You know, we talked about polyphony and heteroglossia and so forth. In polyphony and dialogism, why you have characters who stand for an idea, other characters who stand for an idea, and they get in a quarrel, and so forth. And this happens. Dostoevsky is certainly capable of that. His main characters transcend that, but are part of that world of banter of ideas, goes back and forth.
So you could almost consider Turgenev to be more influential and more sort of a herald of what the novel would become than Dostoevsky.
In part, we see. You know, this is, again, that strange dialogue that happens between the novelists, right? In part, we see some Dostoevsky in Turgenev, and I'm thinking especially of Pavel Pavlovich and his former love, the Princess R, right? An amazing little thumbnail sketch of the Princess R, who is a Dostoevsky character, you know, who lives this wild life by day and by night, paces the floor, transfused with guilt, and finally, is dying and sends him back the Sphinx ring that he had given her. He's saying that the Sphinx perfectly captures your nature, and she was pleased with that, and she had drawn a cross over the Sphinx, sending him back. This is the only answer. This is the only answer to the Sphinx. It's just pure Dostoevsky. It's amazing, you know, and it's before. Of course, just a couple of years before Dostoevsky published *Crime and Punishment*, so you know, amazing. So that current is there. He's listening to, you know, life and its anxieties and fears and its religious extremes in Russia. It's there. Turgenev was again an admirer of Gogol. But of the same generation as Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and so was not friends with either of them. They quarreled with both of them repeatedly. And Tolstoy actually challenged Turgenev to a duel later than this novel, so don't be thinking that was part of an influence, but he took it back, of course, later. And Dostoevsky, who was an addicted gambler, had to remain on somewhat good terms with Turgenev so he could borrow money from him. But not on that great terms. He resented him at the same time, and for, in part, some of that reason. Now, I did print out something for you that we've got just enough time to look at, and I think that this will help sum up where we've been so far, if I can find it. Wonderful handout contrasting Gogol and Turgenev. Oh man, too many slips of paper here. Shucks. I don't know what I did with it. But I will post it on the blackboard if I don't have it to hand out to you. Because really what this handout will show, and I have to say I owe this handout, it's a marvelous teaching device to Louise Cowan, is that in every respect, Gogol and Turgenev represent contrasts of the art of the novel. In narrative style, in form, and how they consider action, and their vision of Russia and their themes. So far, just in having read Dead Souls and Fathers and Sons, you have gotten a great education in what novels in general are about. Well, I'm disappointed. I can't find it, but I'll bring it next time. We'll still be able to talk about it. Now, so what we might say in looking to talking more extensively about Fathers and Sons, some themes that we want to be anticipating, certainly what the title tells us, the conflict of generations, the hopes that fathers have for sons. Now, according to the historian Arnold Toynbee, during a cultural crisis, there's a tendency for people to become either archaists or futurists. And we see that split here in Turgenev's novel. Both sides desert the present that is before them. Archaists seek out an idea of the past, deserting the living presence of the past that is all around them. Futurists desert the present for a future that does not exist, based on a projection of what ought to be. So if you see a conflict between two characters strongly in this novel, keep that in mind. But we see it, in fact, reflected in many characters, in the servants, in Nikolai the father himself, in the family of both Arkady and of Bazarov, in the women that they become interested in, and there are quite a few of those. Now, second theme, so if we have one as the conflict of generations, a second thing would be the loss of faith. The extreme example of Princess R and her quest for faith and that she achieves only in dying is one example. Religion has been relegated to the feminine. Right? The only other example is Bazarov's mother. There's an exquisite portrait, one paragraph of the beliefs of Bazarov's mother. Wait for it, it's terrific. So, and Turgenev ends that paragraph by saying, such was her generation, and I am uncertain, and aren't you going to be uncertain about whether the world is better off or worse off without her. So, it's a precious antique in any case. It's something no longer part of the world that Turgenev himself is portraying. Yeah?
I was wondering this...
the new generation.
The shift of religion, mm-hmm. to the feminine. Was that a new movement in Russian? Because you see the same sort of thing in Dostoevsky and the way he does this as you see in Dante's Vita.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And And so, I mean, it's interesting to me that it would take so long for that sort of thing to make its way over. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's something you probably want to write a paper about.
Okay.
Sounds like an interesting insight. But yeah, no, the idea of atheism, as you were mentioning earlier, is the excitement about it in part is because it's such a new idea, right? It's such a religious country, so it hits with a real force, you know? And exactly in this generation that is the great launch point of the novel. So, also the diverting of heroic qualities. Right? So that we have a wrong-headed hero in Bazarov, a badly educated young man. A nation depends on its leaders, but Bazarov has been ruined by a skeptical European education and believes in nothing, is a nihilist, right? Except believes in his work. But ask yourself whether his work gets done in this novel, right? What it is. Also, we have to say we can't lay it all on the new generation. We have to say the misdirection of the older generation. And an affectionate but really rather negative portrait of the fathers is given in our novel here, the fathers of the two young men that occupy the screen at the beginning of the novel. And of Pavel as well, Nikolai's brother, right? who are no longer connected themselves to the tradition. Pavel models himself not on Russian tradition, but on England, right? And this becomes more explicit as the novel goes on. Nikolai has decided to use new modern techniques to improve his farm, and it seems that he's ended by kind of ruining his farm. And none of this is emphasized very strongly, but we see that's one thing happening. Now, Turgenev is concerned with the sexes, right? And at the same time that he portrays some magnificently independent women, he also shows there's a tendency now of the women of his generation, of this later generation, to be unable to love. Right. Womanhood has become self-concerned.
Would you say feminism?
Well, the novel has always been a proponent of women's liberation. I'm going to just leave it at that. Certainly there are exceptions to that, but I think in general, very strongly so.
I don't mean feminism in a positive sense, like equal rights for women. I mean like in the sense that women who are like, I don't need men, I hate men, go away, all men, oh my gosh. Is so like women want nothing to do with men, and like you said, can't.
I don't think it goes that far in Fathers and Sons, but...
No, I don't think so, but just you're saying inability to love made me...
Yeah, well, it just seems like it's a new type. It's a new portrait. You wouldn't see that anywhere in Shakespeare.
Right.
So, but it along with freedom goes that. Right. It's again a new problem to be dealt with, a new perturbation in society. Yeah.
So that's what you were talking about. He's not really concerned with the idea so much as examining their origins.
And their consequences in life. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, and he has to portray ideas
because
they're part of the scene here. This is Russia. This is that same Russia that is defamiliarized in Gogol, but in Turgenev, we have to come to know it. He feels, well, we have been defamiliarized. We're alienated from the Russia that we stand around. Let's become more aware of it through this art. You can become more aware of your own world. And in fact, it has such power that it's not just for Russians, but for all moderns. So, yeah. Good. All right, so in fact also, again, the comic theme is struck, and there are still young people who are able to love, able to come together, You know, they are not the leaders of society. They are not the ones who are going to hold the flag and go forward and make progress in the world. But life's going to go on. Life is going to go on. And the great comic theme is struck very, very unmistakably at the very end of the novel. So tragedy and comedy together makes the novel. Right? The personal and the political together make the novel. Right? These great antinomies that Turgenev embodies so seemingly effortlessly make his world. Okay, any last comment or question? Anybody who hasn't yet spoken? All right, I can talk to you after, if you like. Yes,
In the introduction, it talks about Pavel Kursinov being the author, being Turgenev's putting himself into the novel. Is that just in the fact that he's someone who's left Russia and talked about Russia, or are there other ways that that's also true? I imagine it's got a pink fingernail.
Turgenev has not, in fact, become an exile at this point. Of course, it was only after he was reviled for this very novel. But certainly, certainly Pavel embodies Turgenev's belief in manners, in honor, in structures, in social structures, and so forth. At the same time, Turgenev did have liberal sympathies, and I think without them, a Bazarov would not have been possible. But it's the realism that allows him to see that no, Bazarov is the man who carries the force at his moment in time. Pavel is the one who must retreat. And how does that happen credibly in those two lives that he's showing? It shows it in an amazingly graceful way. Believable way that Pavel then becomes the person who has to take a back step, who is not the man of force. He seems to be the inheritor of all the old chivalry traditions, and he ought to be wearing the suit of armor coming out there, but he's not. So, it's very fascinating in that way. Eager to talk about all of it with you next time.
Do you ever quiz this?
sorry, next time too.
Did we say?